The Guardian.
Hello, Happy New Year, this is Politics Weekly, I'm Tom Clark. After a couple of weeks of skiving, we're back to striving as Parliament returns with a bitter debate on welfare. Has it set the tone for a divisive year in politics? The Coalition presents its midterm report with a week of press conferences and interviews. Which pledges is it fulfilled and which are the worst of the unkept ones? Is this a refreshing dose of self-criticism in Westminster or is it something more cynical? Joining me for all of this, we have The Guardian's columnists Martin Kettle and Aditya Chakraborty, and alongside them, former Labour press spokesman and political blogger Hopi Sen. A warm welcome to you all. Now, the debate on welfare this week in the House of Commons was a classic piece of skullduggery because there was actually no need at all for it. Rather, it was a tactical device used by George Osborne to force Labour out into the open with a stance on benefits. Labour opposes the government's plan to limit rises in working age payments to 1%, an effective cut to living standards for millions of poor people. Ian Duncan-Smith, the unmovable welfare secretary, turned up the volume in a bid to damn the irresponsibility of the opposition.
For Labour, today's amendment shows, if you read it, if you can even bother to get the end of it without falling asleep, the reality is they are spend more, tax more, borrow more, and let the next generation pick up the bill. This bill is about picking up the pieces, sorting out the deficit, and being a responsible government.
For David Miliband, speaking in the debate, however, this was a rancid bill.
It reeks of the politics of dividing lines that the current government spent so much time denouncing when they were in opposition in the dog days of the Brown administration. It says a lot that within 2 years, they have had to resort to that dividing line politics. We know the style.
Hopi, we didn't announce the wrong Miliband there. It was, in fact, David, as we said. Now, he's sometimes seen as a spokesman for the Blair continuity part of the Labour Party, rightly or wrongly, by contrast with his more left-ish brother. This was seen as a great dilemma for Labour, and yet with the two Milibands united on this one, do you think the whole Labour Party is united on this one?
I think the whole Labour Party is united in opposing what the government's doing. I think there's much more question about what the Labour Party itself would do if it were in government now, and more importantly, if what its manifesto programme should be post-2015. And one sign of that is that when Labour shadow ministers are asked, what will you do for the 2015-16 year, which is the last of the 3 years where the 1% cap is going to be in place, they very carefully avoid answering that. Directly.
They don't answer the question, but do you think that inhibits, or do you think if they were shrewder than they are, perhaps it ought to inhibit the kind of things that they're saying in Parliament right now, the kind of things we had David Miliband saying, they're talking about a rancid piece of legislation?
I think if the Labour Party weren't outraged by this, there would be very much a lot of unhappiness inside the Labour Party about the lack of outrage. And so I think it's a balance between an understandable disagreement with what the government's doing now and wanting to show the passion of that disagreement, and yet an uncertainty, and a reasonable uncertainty, to be fair. It's very difficult for Labour politicians to know what the economic climate's going to be in 2015. It's very difficult for them to know how much money they're going to have available to spend and on what priorities, and therefore a reluctance to commit themselves to any course of action post-2015.
We get a flavour there, Martin, of the trap that George Osborne thought he was setting for Labour. I think it's not that hard to see what they thought the gamble for them would be. You know, we've had these posters around the country saying this week Labour's putting up payments for people on benefits faster than workers' wages. It's the blunt message of the posters. You can see the calculation, but is it a calculation that could go wrong?
Well, it's a calculation that, you know, it won't be a black and white outcome. There's some gain for the Tories if Labour is flat-footed on the question and finds itself simply framed the way the Tories, George Osborne, would like to frame them. But at the same time, the Tories run a risk by this kind of strategy, and Labour is the party of fairness, the party of doing right by people in difficulties because of the economy, out of work, benefits, and so forth. And so, you know, Labour has a strong brand in politics, which is a fairness brand and a decency brand, and not abandoning people who are in economic difficulty. And, you know, that's very appealing to a lot of people in times of recession. So, you know, I think it's a balance outcome there. I mean, I think she's right that Labour is united in not liking the Tories. It's not united about what it does about welfare, because any Labour government coming in 2015 is going to face the fact that the welfare bill is huge and is going to have to do something about that, just as it did when Labour was last in power. But now because of the cuts and because of the recession, the dilemmas are all the more acute.
The big thing Labour's banking on, Aditya, is the large number of people who are in work but getting topped up through tax credits, isn't it?
Yeah. The point about having a decent welfare system is actually that it acts as a kind of safety valve for a market economy, that the people who can't get on in the market economy, who are all shaken out by it, have some kind of safety net for them. And what we're doing effectively is cutting bigger and bigger holes in that safety net. And meanwhile, targeting welfare, we do have a big welfare bill, but targeting it at people who have not fallen out but have never really got into the market economy. And that, I think, is unfair. And I don't hear from any of the main parties any kind of idea about how they would do that. You said, quite rightly, that the Tories are going very hard on this idea of people in work seeing their wages go up less than people on benefit. But the Tories are the ones who are also, you know, doing their best to cut employment regulations and to make life more insecure for people in work. And I find it disappointing that Labour, after having talked a bit about pre-distribution and having a new kind of arrangement between markets and state, still can't actually come up with anything convincing about what they would do about wages or what they would do about the responsibilities of employers to employees as well as the other way around.
Well, on the wages point, I think it's very difficult in a recession, because if you were to try and legislate for living wage level, minimum wage, you would end up with an unemployment effect, and that would probably cause more difficulty than you would hope in terms of poverty than you're hoping to. One thing I think was interesting actually about David Miliband's intervention in the welfare debate is he very specifically said to Ian Duncan Smith, I will accept your overall welfare envelope, which was quite a big shift in terms of the internal politics of the Labour Party.
It's definitely not Labour policy.
And what he then went on to say is that we should then look further at effectively pensioners' benefits. Yes. And I think if you're looking for creative...
That was a powerful line, wasn't it? Yeah. Because at least it then says, so what would you do? Well, he says, well, I would go after pensions tax relief. That is a source of deep discomfort for both the coalition parties, because they'd quite like to do something on pension tax relief for higher earners. In fact, they're beginning to do a cut in it in April. But I still do think, I'm afraid, I slightly regret that we talked so much about Labour, but because I do think Labour are the least interesting party in British politics. You know, they are the party of slow learners that can't quite understand how the world has changed since 2008. And just by plodding along saying, well, we would do stuff to say it's sort of the same as a coalition, but a bit less nastily, I don't think that's much of an offer at all.
Okay, so what should they do?
Well, it would be good, for instance, rather than just talking about pre-distribution, or rather than just talking about, you know, responsibility at the top and responsibility at the bottom, why not think about what institutions you would need to do that? I mean, we are in a world where the unions are not what they were, so what do you replace them with? And rather than talking about the plight of small businesses, why not talk about what big businesses are up to?
Legislate to get big businesses to do different things that they might not want to do, or what?
Well, for instance, rather than have the same old trade union thing, the thing that I was most interested by actually was Unite recently opening up its membership books to people who are unemployed. So anyone can join now for 50p or some token payment. That, it seems to me, is something that the Labour movement ought to do much more of, in that they start saying, OK, so we will now take on people who aren't, you know, don't usually come to us for our usual structures, don't usually come to us with some bloke walking around with a book in which he signs people up as members, but start thinking much more about getting people in from new sources, doing all the things that, you know, critics of Labour activism have always said, that they don't do very well in getting to unorganised labour, they don't do very well at getting in on, you know, cleaners, immigrants, these sorts of things. But starting to think much more about that. So it's a project more, not just for the Labour Party, but I think the Labour Party could play a role in leading that, but for the trade unions too, who after all bound up with the Labour Party.
Certainly are. I mean, I was just thinking, I mean, I think in this area, and if you're casting the net as wide as that for alternatives or, you know, different perspectives from Labour, it seems to me that corporate governance is still the central issue about which, you know, there is room for Labour to really open up a new front in British politics. And, I mean, what I hear from people I talk to within bits of the Labour Party, and we all talk to different people, you know, is that that is on the agenda a bit. And I just wish it was pushed up the agenda. I think it's an issue which has been abandoned in British politics for 40 or 50 years since the failure of the Bullock Report in whenever that was, in the 1970s. And of course, the problem is that the unions are opposed to that sort of model of co-determination on the German lines because they see it as a threat to national collective bargaining, which it is, rightly, and that's why I'm in favour of it.
So they're opposed to it now, or they're opposed to it in the 1970s?
Both, right. Because they live in a permafrost world of large trade unions circa 1926.
Because that structural kind of the labour market is basically dying.
Yeah.
Do you think that opposition is as strong as it was?
No, it's not. It's not as strong because, you know, there aren't Jack Joneses and Hugh Scanlons and Arthur Scargills now. And the reason that there aren't is not because the trade union leadership today is worse people or lesser figures. It's because the trade unions themselves have not modernized. I mean, they have become stuck. And it's a tragedy because, you know, workers' rights and the rights of the employed and all of these things about industrial democracy are really, really important questions. And they're key to an effective economy. But Labour always runs away from them because it gets all its money from the trade unions who are opposed to these
questions.
And
there's another issue in that for Labour as well, which is that because the trade union membership is now so heavily public sector oriented, then the fact that the government is pushing down on public sector employment means that there is increasingly a kind of internal focus for the trade union movement purely on public sector membership and public sector issues. And actually, one of the dangers for the trade union movement is that it stops being about looking outwards in the industrial world and membership in the industrial world and starts being only about protecting membership in the public sector.
On the point about pensioners versus working age people, if we just drag it back to welfare for a second, the development this morning is that the Office for National Statistics, supposedly very great, very good and very numerate people who have no concern with the ballot box whatsoever, have decided they're going to stick with a measure of inflation which benefits pensioners, even though they think it's wrong. Now, I just thought listening to that, if even like unelected people are terrified of the Grey vote, is there any hope at all that by the time of the next election there's going to be a more even-handed approach between...
If you ask me to pick the three or four least sensible economic and fiscal policies in Britain, across all parties, all of them would be related to buying off pensioners. And partly it's a baby boomers. As the baby boomers become edge towards pensioners, there's even more kind of frightening because there's a population and also a cultural bulge of people who are about to enter that rate. And I mean, so whether it's the triple lock, whether it's winter fuel allowance, whether it's taxation, across the spectrum, right up and down, there is a ridiculous level of over support for pensions compared to what any other field in the British labour or social market, from childcare to universities to being a student. So it's a huge structural problem, and yet whoever is it's kind of like Social Security in America. It's a third rail issue. Every politician is worried that if you touch it, then you'll be the one who gets destroyed and ripped apart.
But Aditya, there is the benefits bill might be skewed towards pensioners, but you can't ignore all the other stuff you write about the whole time, quantitative easing, interest rates and all of those things
which have decimated savings, which means that anyone who's about to take on, you know, an annuity or whatever will find themselves in a pretty poor position. So actually, if we are still in a world of zero rates as more and more baby boomers sort of come off the labour market, then they face a pretty grim prospect. I would agree with a lot of what Hopi said. The only thing you must do, obviously, you must put in the caveat that we do have responsibilities to people on pensions. They've worked and they've put in money and they deserve a decent retirement income. The one thing I would say, though, is frame it differently. Frame it not as pensions versus the rest of us. Frame it as our obligations to the past versus our obligations to the future. Because what we're doing by being extra worried about, you know, the bond markets, which are historic debts, being worried about pensioners, which are historically workers, and skewing our concern towards them rather than thinking about capital investment or thinking about childcare or all these other things, means that we are effectively shoveling more and more of our money towards past obligations rather than thinking about new obligations.
That's a a neat way of summing it up I've not seen before. So let's leave that there for now. There's always lots more on welfare at guardian.co.uk/politics.
This week on the Guardian Audio Edition, David Cameron's threat to block EU reforms branded economic insanity. Some surprising facts about hedgehogs. And in our audiobook review, we look at feminist audiobooks by Germaine Greer and Natasha Walter. To subscribe for free to The Guardian Audio Edition, go to audible.co.uk/guardian or find us on SoundCloud and iTunes. The Guardian Audio Edition, a new way to get the whole picture.
After a pretty bleak 2012, David Cameron and Nick Clegg chose this week to reaffirm their commitment to the coalition and to publish a midterm progress report. It's a kind of thing that Lord Leveson might have referred to as marking your own homework. And its omissions were pounced upon by a gleeful opposition. Martin, we're essentially halfway through the parliament, and before we get onto the chart of, you know, 700 pledges hit and 70 missed or whatever, there's one big thing you've got to hand to the coalition, isn't there, which is that they've got through this long, and a lot of people thought they wouldn't.
Well, a lot of people did say they wouldn't. I have to say I wasn't amongst them, because I think, you know, you just look at the fact that the numbers stack up for the coalition in the House of Commons. You can't defeat the coalition if you haven't got enough votes to defeat them. And the two parties locked themselves into an agreement, which was very difficult to break. And the Liberal Democrats in particular locked themselves very firmly in by putting it to a membership ballot before they agreed to go in. And it was virtually unanimous. So it's a very strong political and moral lock keeping them there. So the fact that they legislated for it in order to stop basically the Tories from doing the dirty on the Lib Dems halfway through when it suited them, is a pretty powerful thing. And that's so I'm personally not surprised at all. I think it will go right down to the wire. And, there's nothing that anyone else can really do about it. So, I think the fact that the coalition has held together and will more or less hold together in different circumstances should not be surprising. The great thing that I think we can draw from this is that coalition government works. Until 2010, the absolute shared assumption of the main parties, i.e. Labour and the Tories, was that coalition government was a disaster and could not work. Well, you know, whatever you think about this coalition, it's worked well. People in Whitehall are clear that it's been quite efficient. It's been quite good for cabinet government and stuff like that, which is, you know, we all, you know, on certain occasions think that's a very, very good thing. And so, you know, from a process point of view, it's actually worked surprisingly efficiently. Now, unless and until we get into a situation in this country where one party really does have a hegemonic political project, as the Blair Labour Party did at one point in the 1990s, we are in effect in a situation in which we are going to have the prospect of coalition government in the future in this country. We have a proliferation of parties. You can see that happening with the growth of UKIP at the moment, but there are lots of other examples of it over the last 15 or 20 years. And if we ever were to get a fairer electoral system, we'd be into Borgen politics. And, you know, I think that's a good thing, not a bad thing.
I'd like to ask a question, if I may, to Martin Sahopi. I was talking about how we've got proof that coalition works, there is another statement which I was quite striking this week, which was David Cameron saying that he expects to be in place, or we would like to be in place, for another 7 years. There was no such statement from Nick Clegg. So if coalition works, is it the case that we've shown that the system works, but not necessarily all the actors are that signed up to it?
Well, I do think that's true. I mean, it's obviously more difficult for the minor party, and it's particularly difficult for a minor party like the Liberal Democrats, who have never been in government before and which has a long culture of oppositionism and grandstanding and has a kind of moral project of disapproving of what government is doing from a fairly high-minded position, not unfamiliar to readers of The Guardian. And I think, you know, the problem for the Liberal Democrats is they've got to get, you know, they've had to learn how to live dirty. And, you know, I think Nick Clegg has carried an awful lot of the penalty of that. And, you know, I certainly don't think it's inconceivable that Nick Clegg will lose the leadership of the Liberal Democrats before the next general election, simply because the ratings of the party are very low.
He'll lose it, not give it up.
Well, whichever. I mean, that's a distinction which, you know...
AP, he's taking to the airwaves this morning to do radio phone-in. How do you think that's going to go?
I gather from Twitter it's already gone very badly. It's the first question or second question was someone saying they'd torn up their 35-year Lib Dem membership, who'd torn up their membership card. I think it's a good thing. I mean, even despite that, even if it's gone badly, or if everyone sort of on Twitter or on the blogs is going to make sort of smart-aleck remarks about it, I think it's a good thing for politicians to do this sort of stuff. I mean, Tony Blair did the kind of masochism strategy ahead of the 2005 election, and I think exposing yourself to the wrath of voters, if voters are angry with you, is the better option than hiding away from them. And certainly doing it now and committing to do it regularly is better than what David Cameron's done, which is kind of to hide away a little bit from both the press and from public scrutiny in terms of these kind of
how much you need.
Cameron's
to
actually pretty good at it.
How much you need to react to the wrath of voters, though? I mean, masochism strategy was always you must listen to them, but what do you do in response to that?
Well, Clegg's in a different position. I mean, he doesn't need to get the kind of level of support that a government or opposition party needs to get. He needs to persuade maybe 5% of the electorate who did vote or considered voting Lib Dem in 2010 to stick with him. So I think you know, he will, if he's got any sense, have a very clear picture in his mind the sort of people who have left the Lib Dems but would consider coming back, and what their issues are. And so those are the people he's got to talk to. And really, everyone else is less important in his kind of in reacting to their wrath. So people who have left the Lib Dems and are never, ever coming back, well, he really is not going to, shouldn't worry too much about them in terms of his own political
There's
structure.
No magic bullet on these things, I think. I mean, I think, you know, Blair's masochism strategy didn't actually work. Blair remained he was popular, but also very unpopular with a lot of people who had previously voted Labour. Likewise with Clegg. I mean, he can kind of beat himself in public do whatever he wants to do to show how much he's suffering. But it's not going to really turn his position around. I happen to think history will think better of Nick Clegg than the voters will in the next general election. I mean, I think he's objectively quite a significant politician because of the existence of the coalition and, you know, in the history of the Liberal Democrats over time. But I think his chances of leading into the next election are pretty slim.
But I wanted to pick up the point about coalition quickly. I think one of the interesting things about politics at the moment is that it's actually pre-Second World War politics is a much better model of party formation and government formation, where there are a lot more coalitions. And actually, the post-Second World War kind of huge two-party, almost no third party model doesn't give us a particularly good guide. And one of the interesting things about that is if you look at the kind of the model of the third party or the junior leader in a coalition government kind of before the Second World War, almost all of them end up pretty much rejected by voters and at least for a considerable period of time history. So whether it's kind of Joe Chamberlain or Austin Chamberlain or Ramsay MacDonald or, you know, any of the junior figures in a coalition.
Or Herbert Samuel,
yeah. And I think that might well be Nick Clegg's fate as well.
Okay, before we go into too many factions of the interwar Liberals, let's talk about this coalition right here, right now for a moment, Aditya. 700 pledges, or God knows how many it was. One pledge mattered above all else. It was the defining mission for the coalition when it was established, reducing the debt and the deficit. There's been a bit of attention this morning, not just on how the government's doing on that pledge, but how it's communicated the way it thinks it's doing.
Look, no one can say that the government's economic strategy has been a success. Not even people in government would say that, right? Because by now we should be on the, if things were running as they've been projected to, you know, when the coalition government was formed, by now we'd be on the turn and we'd be on our way to 2% growth next year and then 3% growth, in time for the elections.
What about just the deficit, though?
But the deficit is a function of that. Because what's happened is borrowing has gone up because the economy's not produced the kind of tax revenues that we'd hoped for. And so what the government's been forced to do is to shovel more and more sort of special, whizzy, tricky accounting to try and massage down the debt figures. But it's not been a success. And one of the things that is interesting about, you know, the renewal of vows this week, the joint press conference, was how little they talked about the economy. It is no good shucking all the responsibility off for the underperformance of the British economy onto the Eurozone crisis, onto the global slump. That certainly does carry some of the responsibility, but doesn't do all of it. Doing this kind of severe counterproductive austerity amid a global slump will, in the end, I think, be seen as a particularly disastrous move by the government. And it will damage long-term growth prospects for Britain for way, you know, way past the general election. I mean, I think we've done serious long-term damage now to the UK economy.
So you're not just making the kind of Keynesian point that you cut in the slump and the slump gets deeper, but you're saying something deeper changes.
I don't agree with Keynesians, because I think they sort of tend to think that if you just press a couple of buttons and you spend a bit more of this there, and then suddenly things will work a bit better, and then you'd reverse it all, you know, when things are better. There is, from an economic management point of view, there is certainly, you know, it is stupid to cut amid a slump. But I think also 2008 should have been the time at which we sat down and thought, okay, so the world is, you know, all the assumptions that we, or a lot of the assumptions that we made about what it takes to have a good and growing economy have now been shot to pieces. What do we do, and how do we think differently? And I don't see any of the political parties which have really sort of faced up to that. But since Coalition are in power, since Lib Dems and Conservatives are in power, they must, you know, they're the ones who are responsible, and they've not thought about it at all, I don't think.
One of my points to just react to that is I think a lot of the problem is about what mix of spending you end up with, because one of the consequences of cutting in a slump is you end up not having the ability to move your spending over to capital and infrastructure, yeah, and investment spending, which is what you need to do as you come out of the slump, so that you've got that increased capacity for the long term.
Except there are no votes in new bridges, because bridges don't exist until you've actually built them. There are lots of votes in shucking money at pensioners.
Okay, well, let's people can go and look for themselves on the Guardian website at how Guardian analysts think the government's doing on its own pledge card, its own score sheet. But before we close this New Year edition of Politics Weekly, let's just go around the table and force everyone to come up with one thing, one fact that they think is going to emerge in 2013. Hopi, I'm going to start with you first.
I think it will be that Labour's biggest challenge will be whether or not to commit to the baseline of government spending, and that will form the fundamental problem for Labour over the next year and a half.
That's Labour's problem. Which way do you think Labour will jump?
I think in the end it'll accept the baseline with three or four big changes, which will be presented as a tax bombshell by the Conservatives.
So the next election firming up, Aditya, any tea leaves visible?
Well, these are tough times for retailers of all kinds, especially of opinions. So I'll give you a buy one, get one. I think the one fact that will emerge this year is Britain will lose its AAA credit rating from one or other of the three main agencies. And that will cause a huge amount of angst for the coalition, since what was this austerity about if not to shore up Britain's reputation in financial markets? I think the more general point will be that we've been through 2.5-3 years of a kind of a false battle between Austerians, people who would like to cut further, and like Keynesians, and I think we will see the exhaustion of both positions and a kind of a sense that actually we need to do something else.
Martin?
Well, I think that Europe will be a good news story in 2013. I think that the European Union will continue to struggle its way through the Eurozone crisis rather than capitulate and fragment because of it. And I think that the European debate in this country will, at the 11th hour, which is more or less where we are, begin to take on a slight tinge of realism and reality. You can see this from the US government and from the industrialists who have been saying that the Tories must not be quite so stupid about Europe, and they're putting things in danger. I think, actually, that we're going to at last have a serious case for Europe. We'll re-enter British politics, not before time. I'm hoping that possibly the return of David Miliband to the front bench might make this a little easier.
So, from your point of view, I guess that's good news on Europe in more than one sense. That's all we've got time for. My thanks to Martin, to Aditya and to Hopi. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
For more
more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.